Sophie Moll. Thimble drinker. Coffin cartwheeler. She walked down the runway, the smell of London in her hair. Yellow bottoms of bells flapped backwards around her ankles. Long hair floated out from under her straw hat. One hand in her mother's, the other swinging like a soldier's. Left, 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 right, left. There was a girl, tall and thin and fair. Her hair was the delicate color of ginger. Left, left, right. There was a girl. Margaret Kutchmer told her to stop it. So she stopped it. Amu said, "Can you see her, Rahel?" She turned around to find her crisp knickered daughter communing with cement marsupials. She went and fetched her scoldingly. Chaco said he couldn't take Rahel on his shoulders because he was already carrying something. Two roses red. Fatly. Fondly. When Sophie Moll walked into the arrivals lounge, Rahel, overcome by excitement and resentment, pinched Esther hard, his skin between her nails. Esther gave her a Chinese bangle, twisting the skin on her wrist different ways with each of his hands. Her skin became a welt and hurt. When she licked it, it tasted of salt. The spit on her wrist was cool and comfortable. Amu never noticed. Across the tall iron railing that separated meters from the Met and greeters from the Gret, Chaco, beaming, bursting through his suit and sideways tie, bowed to his new daughter and ex-wife. In his mind, Esther said, "Bow." "Hello, ladies," Chaco said in his reading aloud voice. Last night's voice in which he said love, madness, hope, infinite joy. "And how was your journey?" And the air was full of thoughts and things to say. But at times like these, only the small things are ever said. The big things lurk unsaid inside. "Say hello and how do you do," Margaret Kutchmer said to Sophie Moll. "Hello and how do you do," Sophie Moll said through the iron railing to everyone in particular. "One for you and one for you," Chaco said with his roses. "And thank you," Margaret Kutchmer said to Sophie Moll. "And thank you," Sophie Moll said to Chaco, mimicking her mother's question mark. Margaret Kutchmer shook her a little for her impertinence. "You're welcome," Chaco said. "Now let me introduce everybody." Then, more for the benefit of onlookers and eavesdroppers, because Margaret Kutchmer needed no introduction, really, "My wife, Margaret." Margaret Kutchmer smiled and wagged her rose at him. "Ex-wife Chaco," her lips formed the words, though her voice never spoke them. Anybody could see that Chaco was a proud and happy man to have had a wife like Margaret. White, in a flowered printed frock with legs underneath, and brown back freckles on her back, and arm freckles on her arms. But around her the air was sad somehow, and behind the smile in her eyes, the grief was a fresh, shining blue, because of a calamitous car crash, because of a Joe-shaped hole in the universe. "Hello, Wall," she said. "I feel I've known you for years." "Hello, Wall." "My daughter, Sophie," Chaco said, and laughed a small, nervous laugh that was worried in case Margaret Kutchmer said, "Ex-daughter," but she didn't. It was an easy-to-understand laugh. Not like the orange-drink-lemon-drink man's laugh that Esther hadn't understood. "Hello," Sophie Moll said. She was taller than Esther. And bigger. Her eyes were blue-gray-blue. Her pale skin was the color of beach sand. But her hatted hair was beautiful, deep red-brown. And yes, oh yes, she had Papachi's nose waiting inside hers. An imperial entomologist's nose within a nose. A moth lover's nose. She carried her made-in-England go-go bag that she loved. "Amu, my sister," Chaco said. Amu said a grown-up's hello to Margaret Kuchema and a children's hello to Sophie Moll. Rahel watched, hawk-eyed, to try and gauge how much Amu loved Sophie Moll, but couldn't. Laughter rambled through the arrivals' lounge like a sudden breeze. Adur Bhashi, the most popular, best-loved comedian in Malayalam cinema, had just arrived. Bombay Kuchan. Burdened with a number of small, unmanageable packages and unabashed public adulation, he felt obliged to perform. He kept dropping his packages and saying, "Enda devame, ee sadhanangal." Esther laughed a high, delighted laugh. "Amu, look, Adur Bhashi's dropping his things," Esther said. "He can't even carry his things." "He's doing it deliberately," Baby Kuchma said in a strange new British accent. "Just ignore him." "He's a film actor," she explained to Margaret Kuchma and Sophie Moll, making Adur Bhashi sound like a mactor who did occasionally fill. "Just trying to attract attention," Baby Kuchma said, and resolutely refused to have her attention attracted. But Baby Kuchma was wrong. Adur Bhashi wasn't trying to attract attention. He was only trying to deserve the attention that he had already attracted. "My aunt, Baby," Chako said. Sophie Moore was puzzled. She regarded Baby Kuchma with a beady-eyed interest. She knew of cow babies and dog babies, bear babies, yes. She would soon point out to Rahel a bat baby. But aunt babies confounded her. Baby Kuchma said, "Hello, Margaret," and "Hello, Sophie Moll." She said Sophie Moll was so beautiful that she reminded her of a wood sprite, of Ariel. "Do you know who Ariel was?" Baby Kuchma asked Sophie Moll. "Ariel in the Tempest?" Sophie Moll said she didn't. "Where the bee sucks, there suck I," Baby Kuchma said. Sophie Moll said she didn't. "In a cowslip's bell I lie?" Sophie Moll said she didn't. "Shakespeare's The Tempest?" Baby Kuchma persisted. All this was, of course, primarily to announce her credentials to Margaret Kuchma, to set herself apart from the sweeper class. "She's trying to boast," Ambassador E. Pelvis whispered in Ambassador S. Insect's ear. Ambassador Rahel's giggle escaped in a blue-green bubble, the color of a jackfruit fly, and burst in the hot airport air. "Fft," was the sound it made. Baby Kuchma saw it and knew that it was Esther who had started it. "And now for the VIPs," Chako said, still using his reading aloud voice. "My nephew, Esther Penn." "Elvis Presley," Baby Kuchma said for revenge. "I'm afraid we're a little behind the times here." Everyone looked at Esther and laughed. From the soles of Ambassador Esther's beige and pointy shoes, an angry feeling rose and stopped around his heart. "How do you do, Esther Penn?" Margaret Kuchma said.
"Fine, thank you." Esther's voice was sullen.
"Esther," Amu said affectionately, "when someone says, 'How do you do?' you're supposed to say, 'How do you do?' back, not 'Fine, thank you.' Come on, say, 'How do you do?'" Ambassador Esther looked at Amu. "Go on," Amu said to Esther. "How do you do?" Esther's sleepy eyes were stubborn. In Malayalam, Amu said, "Did you hear what I said?" Ambassador Esther felt blue-gray-blue eyes on him, and an imperial entomologist's nose. He didn't have a "how do you do" in him.
"Esther Penn," Amu said,
and an angry feeling rose in her and stopped around her heart. A far more angry than necessary feeling. She felt somehow humiliated by this public revolt in her area of jurisdiction. She had wanted a smooth performance, a prize for her children in the Indo-British behavior competition. Chako said to Amu in Malayalam, "Please, later, not now." And Amu's angry eyes on Esther said, "All right, later." And later became a horrible, menacing, goosebumpy word. Lay. Ter. Like a deep-sounding bell in a mossy well, shivery and furred. Like moth's feet. The play had gone bad, like pickle in the monsoon. "And my niece," Chako said. "Where's Rahel?"
He looked around and couldn't find her. Ambassador Rahel, unable to cope with seesawing changes in her life, had raveled herself like a sausage into the dirty airport curtain and wouldn't unravel. A sausage with bata sandals. Just ignore her, Amu said. She's just trying to attract attention. Amu too was wrong. Rahel was trying to not attract the attention that she deserved. Hello, Rahel, Margaret Kochma said to the dirty airport curtain. How do you do? The dirty curtain replied in a mumble. Aren't you going to come out and say hello? Margaret Kochma said in a kind schoolteacher voice, like Miss Mittens before she saw Satan in their eyes. Ambassador Rahel wouldn't come out of the curtain because she couldn't. She couldn't because she couldn't. Because everything was wrong. And soon there would be a later for both her and Esther, full of furred moths and icy butterflies, and deep-sounding bells, and moss, and a nowl. The dirty airport curtain was a great comfort, and a darkness, and a shield. Just ignore her, Amu said and smiled tightly. Rahel's mind was full of millstones with blue-gray-blue eyes. Amu loved her even less now. And it had come down to brass tacks with Chako. Here comes the baggage, Chako said brightly, glad to get away. Come, Sophiekins, let's get your bags. Sophiekins. Esther watched as they walked along the railing, pushing through the crowds that moved aside, intimidated by Chako's suit and sideways tie and his generally bursty demeanor. Because of the size of his stomach, Chako carried himself in a way that made him appear to be walking uphill all the time, negotiating optimistically the steep, slippery slopes of life. He walked on this side of the railing, Margaret Kochma and Sophie Moll on that. Sophiekins. The sitting man with the cap and epaulettes, also intimidated by Chako's suit and sideways tie, allowed him into the baggage claim section. When there was no railing left between them, Chako kissed Margaret Kochma and then picked Sophie Moll up. The last time I did this, I got a wet shirt for my pains, Chako said and laughed. He hugged her and hugged her and hugged her. He kissed her blue-gray-blue eyes, her entomologist's nose, her hatted red-brown hair. Then Sophie Moll said to Chako, excuse me, do you think you could put me down now? I'm, not really used to being carried. So Chako put her down. Ambassador Esther saw, with stubborn eyes, that Chako's suit was suddenly looser, less bursty. And while Chako got the bags, at the dirty curtained window, later became now. Esther saw how Baby Kochma's neck mole licked its chops and throbbed with delicious anticipation. Der-doom, der-doom. It changed color like a chameleon. Der-green, der-blue-black, der-mustard-yellow. Twins for tea, it would be. All right, Amu said, that's enough, both of you. Come out of there, Rahel. Inside the curtain, Rahel closed her eyes and thought of the green river, of the quiet, deep-swimming fish, and the gossamer wings of the dragonflies that could see behind them in the sun. She thought of her luckiest fishing rod that Velita had made for her, yellow bamboo with a float that dipped every time a foolish fish inquired. She thought of Velita and wished she was with him. Then Esther unraveled her. The cement kangaroos were watching. Amu looked at them. The air was quiet except for the sound of Baby Kuchma's throbbing neck mole. So, Amu said. And it was really a question. So? And it hadn't an answer. Ambassador Esther looked down and saw that his shoes, from where the angry feelings rose, were beige and pointy. Ambassador Rahel looked down and saw that in her bata sandals, her toes were trying to disconnect themselves. twitching to join someone else's feet, and that she couldn't stop them. Soon she'd be without toes and have a bandage, like the leper at the level crossing. "If you ever," Amu said, "and I mean this, ever, ever again disobey me in public, I will see to it that you are sent away to somewhere where you will jolly well learn to behave. Is that clear?" When Amu was really angry, she said, "Jolly well." Jolly well was a deeply well with laughing dead people in it. "Is that clear?" Amu said again. Frightened eyes and a fountain looked back at Amu. Sleepy eyes and a surprised puff looked back at Amu. Two heads nodded three times. "Yes, it's clear." But Baby Kuchma was dissatisfied with the fizzling out of a situation that had been so full of potential. She tossed her head. "As if," she said. "As if." Amu turned to her, and the turn of her head was a question. "It's useless," Baby Kuchma said. "They're sly. They're uncouth, deceitful. They're growing wild. You can't manage them." Amu turned back to Esther and Rahel, and her eyes were blurred jewels. "Everybody says that children need a baba, and I say no, not my children. Do you know why?" Two heads nodded. "Why? Tell me," Amu said. And not together, but almost, Esteban and Rahel said, "Because you're our Amu and our baba, and you love us double." "More than double," Amu said. "So remember what I told you. People's feelings are precious, and when you disobey me in public, everybody gets the wrong impression." "What ambassadors and a half you've been," Baby Kuchma said. Ambassador E. Pelvis and Ambassador S. Insect hung their heads. "And the other thing, Rahel," Amu said, "I think it's high time that you learned the difference between clean and dirty, especially in this country." Ambassador Rahel looked down. "Your dress was clean," Amu said. "That curtain is dirty. Those kangaroos are dirty. Your hands are dirty." Rahel was frightened by the way Amu said clean and dirty so loudly, as though she was talking to a deaf person. "Now I want you to go and say hello properly," Amu said. "Are you going to do that or not?" Two heads nodded twice. Ambassador Esther and Ambassador Rahel walked toward Sophie Mall. "Where do you think people are sent to jolly well behave?" Esther asked Rahel in a whisper. "To the government," Rahel whispered back, because she knew. "How do you do?" Esther said to Sophie Mall, loud enough for Amu to hear. "Just like a ladu, one pice too," Sophie Mall whispered to Esther. She had learned this in school from a Pakistani classmate. Esther looked at Amu. Amu's look said, "Never mind her, as long as you've done the right thing." On their way across the airport car park, hot weather crept into their clothes and dampened crisp knickers. The children lagged behind, weaving through parked cars and taxis. "Does yours hit you?" Sophie Mall asked. Rahel and Esther, unsure of the politics of this, said nothing. "Mine does," Sophie Mall said invitingly. "Mine even slaps." "Ours doesn't," Esther said loyally. "Lucky," Sophie Mall said. "Lucky rich boy with pocket money and a grandmother's factory to inherit. No worries." They walked past the Class 3 Airport Workers Union token one-day hunger strike, and past the people watching the Class 3 Airport Workers Union token one-day hunger strike, and past the people watching the people watching the people. A small tin sign on a big banyan tree said, "For VD sex complaints, contact Dr. OK Joy." "Who do you love most in the world?" Rahel asked Sophie Moore. "Joe," Sophimol said without hesitation. My dad. He died 2 months ago. We've come here to recover from the shock. But Charco's your dad, Esther said.
He's just my real dad, Sophimol said. Joe's my dad. He never hits, hardly ever.
How can he hit if he's dead? Esther asked reasonably.
Where's your dad? Sophimol wanted to know.
He's...
And Rahel looked at Esther for help.
Not here, Esther said.
Shall I tell you my list? Rahel asked Sophimol.
If you like, Sophimol said.
Rahel's list was an attempt to order chaos. She revised it constantly, torn forever between love and duty. It was by no means a true gauge of her feelings.
First, Amu and Chaco, Rahel said. Then, Mamachi.
Our grandmother, Esther clarified.
More than your brother? Sophimol asked.
We don't count, Rahel said. And anyway, he might change, Amu says.
How do you mean? Change into what? Sophimol asked.
Into a male chauvinist pig, Rahel said.
Very unlikely, Esther said.
Anyway, after Mamachi, Velita, and then...
Who's Velita?
Sophimol wanted to know.
A man we love, Rahel said.
And after Velita, you, Rahel said.
Me? What do you love me for? Sophimol said.
Because we're first cousins, so I have to, Rahel said piously.
But you don't even know me, Sophimol said.
And anyway, I don't love you.
But you will. When you come to know me, Rahel said confidently.
I doubt it, Esther said.
Why not? Sophimol said.
Because, Esther said. And anyway, she's most probably going to be a dwarf.
As though loving a dwarf was completely out of the question.
I'm not, Rahel said.
You are, Esther said.
I'm not.
You are.
I'm not.
You are.
We're twins, Esther explained to Sophimol. And just see how much shorter she is.
Rahel obligingly took a deep breath, threw her chest out and stood back to back with Esther in the airport car park for Sophimol to see just how much shorter she was.
Maybe you'll be a midget, Sophimol suggested. That's taller than a dwarf and shorter than a human being.
The silence was unsure of this compromise. In the doorway of the arrivals lounge, a shadowy, red-mouthed, rue-shaped silhouette waved a cemently paw only at Rahel. Cement kisses whirred through the air like small helicopters.
Do you know how to sachet? Sophimol wanted to know.
No, we don't sachet in India, Ambassador Esther said. Well, in England we do, Sophimol said. All the models do. On television. Look, it's easy. And the three of them, led by Sophimol, sashayed across the airport car park, swaying like fashion models, eagle flasks and made-in-England go-go bags bumping around their hips. Damp dwarfs, walking tall.
Shadows followed them, silver jets in a blue church sky, like moths in a beam of light. The sky-blue Plymouth with tail fins had a smile for Sophimol. A chrome-bumpered shark smile. A Paradise Pickles car's smile. When she saw the carrier with the painted pickle bottles and the list of Paradise products, Marco Kutma said,
Oh dear, I feel as though I'm in an advertisement.
She said, Oh dear, a lot.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear.
I didn't know you did pineapple slices, she said.
Sophie loves pineapple, don't you, Soph?
Sometimes.
Soph said, and sometimes not.
Margaret Kochima climbed into the advertisement, with her brown back freckles and her arm freckles and her flower dress with legs underneath. Sophimol sat in front, between Charco and Margaret Kochima, just her hat peeping over the car seat, because she was their daughter. Rahel and Esther sat at the back. The luggage was in the boot. Boot was a lovely word. Sturdy was a terrible word. Near Etumanur, they passed a dead temple elephant.
electrocuted by a high-tension wire that had fallen on the road. An engineer from the Etimanur municipality was supervising the disposal of the carcass. They had to be careful because the decision would serve as a precedent for all future government pachyderm carcass disposals. Not a matter to be treated lightly. There was a fire engine and some confused firemen. The municipal officer had a file and was shouting a lot. There was a Joy ice cream cart and a man selling peanuts in narrow cones of paper, cleverly designed to hold not more than 8 or 9 nuts. Sophimore said, "Look, a dead elephant!" Chaco stopped to ask whether it was, by any chance, Kochetomben, Little Tusker, the Imanam temple elephant who came to the Imanam house once a month for a coconut. They said it wasn't. Relieved that it was a stranger and not an elephant they knew, they drove on. "Thank God," Esther said. "Thank God, Esther," Baby Kuchma corrected him. On the way, Sophimore learned to recognize the first whiff of the approaching stench of unprocessed rubber and to clamp her nostrils shut until long after the truck carrying it had driven past. Baby Kuchma suggested a car song. Esther and Rahel had to sing in English in obedient voices, breezily, as though they hadn't been made to rehearse it all week long. Ambassador E. Pelvis and Ambassador S. Insect. "Ridge ois in the law ord, or always, and again I say rejoice." Their pronunciation was perfect. The Plymouth rushed through the green midday heat, promoting pickles on its roof, and the sky blue sky in its tail fins. Just outside Imanam, they drove into a cabbage green butterfly. Or perhaps it drove into them. Chapter 7. Wisdom Exercise Notebooks. In Papachi's study, mounted butterflies and moths had disintegrated into small heaps of iridescent dust that powdered the bottom of their glass display cases, leaving the pins that had impaled them naked. Cruel. The room was rank with fungus and disuse. An old neon green hula hoop hung from a wooden peg on the wall, a huge saint's discarded halo. A column of shining black ants walked across a windowsill, their bottoms tilted upwards, like a line of mincing chorus girls in a Busby Berkeley musical, silhouetted against the sun, buffed and beautiful. Rahel, on a stool on top of a table, rummaged in a book cupboard with dull, dirty glass panes. Her bare footprints were clear in the dust on the floor. They led from the door to the table, dragged to the bookshelf, to the stool, dragged to the table and lifted onto it. She was looking for something. Her life had a size and a shape now. She had half moons under her eyes and a team of trolls on her horizon. On the top shelf, the leather binding on Papachi's set of The Insect Wealth of India had lifted off each book and buckled like corrugated asbestos. Silverfish tunneled through the pages, burrowing arbitrarily from species to species, turning organized information into yellow lace. Rahel groped behind the row of books and brought out hidden things. A smooth seashell and a spiky one. A plastic case for contact lenses. An orange pipette. A silver crucifix on a string of beads. Baby Gutma's rosary. She held it up against the light. Each greedy bead grabbed its share of sun. A shadow fell across the sunlit rectangle on the study floor. Rahel turned towards the door with her string of light. "Imagine. It's still here. I stole it after you were returned." That word slipped out easily. Returned. As though that was what twins were meant for, to be borrowed and returned, like library books. Esther wouldn't look up. His mind was full of trains. He blocked the light from the door, an Esther-shaped hole in the universe. Behind the books, Rahel's puzzled fingers encountered something else. Another magpie had had the same idea. She brought it out and wiped the dust off with the sleeve of her shirt. It was a flat packet, wrapped in clear plastic and stuck with sellotape. A scrap of white paper inside it said, Estepen and Rahel, in Amu's writing. There were four tattered notebooks in it. On their covers they said, Wisdom Exercise Notebooks, with a place for name, school/college, class, subject. Two had her name on them and two Esther's. Inside the back cover of one, something had been written in a child's handwriting. The labored form of each letter and the irregular space between words was full of the struggle for control over the errant, self-willed pencil. The sentiment, in contrast, was lucid. I hate Miss Mitten, and I think her knickers are torn. On the front of the book, Esther had rubbed out his surname with spit and taken half the paper with it. Over the whole mess he had written in pencil, unknown. Estepen, unknown. His surname postponed for the time being, while Amu chose between her husband's name and her father's. Next to class it said, 6 years. Next to subject it said, story writing. Rahel sat cross-legged on the stool, on the table. Estepen unknown, she said. She opened the book and read aloud. When Ulysses came home, his son came and said, Father, I thought you would not come back. Many princes came, and each wanted to marry Penelope. But Penelope said that the man who can stoot through the 12 rings can marry me. And everyone failed, and Ulysses came to the palace dressed like a beggar and asked if he could try. The men all laughed at him and said, If we can't do it, you can't. Ulysses' son stopped them and said, Let him try, and he took the bow and shot right through the 12 rings. Below this there were corrections from a previous lesson. Ferris, 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 Ferris. Learned, 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 learned. Neither, 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 neither. Carriages, carriages. Bridge, bridge. Bearer, bearer. Fastened, fastened. Laughter curled around the edges of Rahel's voice. Safety first, she announced. Amu had drawn a wavy line down the length of the page with a red pen and written, Margin? And joint handwriting in future, please. When we walk on the road in the town, cautious Esther's story went, we should always walk on the pavement. If you go on the pavement, there is no traffic to cause accidents. But on the main road there is so much dangerous traffic that they can easily knock you down and make you senseless or a cripple. If you break your head or backbone, you will be very unfortunate. Policemen can direct the traffic so that there won't be too many invalids to go to hospital. When we get out of the bus, we should do so only after asking the conductor, or we will be injured and make the doctors have a busy time. The job of a driver is very fatal. His family should be very anxious because the driver could easily be dead. Morbid kid, Rahel said to Esther. As she turned the page, something reached into her throat, plucked her voice out, shook it down, and returned it without its laughing edges. Esther's next story was called Little Amu. In joint handwriting, the tails of the F's and G's were curled and looped. The shadow in the doorway stood very still. On Saturday, we went to a bookshop in Kortem to buy Amu a present because her birthday is in 17th of November. We bought her a diary. We hid it in the cupboard, and then it began to be night. Then we said, Do you want to see your present? She said, Yes, I would like to see it. And we wrote on the paper, For a little Amu with love from Esther and Rahel,
And we gave it to Amu and she said, what a lovely present, it's just what I wanted. And then we talked for a little while, and we talked about the diary, then we gave her a kiss and went to bed. We talked with each other and went off to sleep. We had a little dream. After some time, I got up and I was very thirsty and I went to Amu's room and said, I am thirsty. Amu gave me water and I was just going to my bed when Amu called me and said, come and sleep with me. And I lay at the back of Amu and talked to Amu and went off to sleep. After a little while, I got up and we talked again, and after that we had a midnight feast. We had orange coffee banana. Afterwards, Rahel came and we ate two more bananas and we gave a kiss to Amu because it was her birthday. Afterwards, we sang happy birthday. Then in the morning, we had new cloths from Amu as a back present. Rahel was a Maharani and I was Little Nehru. Amu had corrected the spelling mistakes and below the essay had written, if I am talking to somebody, you may interrupt me only if it is very urgent. When you do, please say, excuse me. I will punish you very severely if you disobey these instructions. Please complete your corrections. Little Amu, who never completed her corrections, who had to pack her bags and leave, because she had no locusts stand eye. Because Chako said she had destroyed enough already. Who came back to Imanum with asthma and a rattle in her chest that sounded like a faraway man shouting. Esther never saw her like that. Wild. Sick. Sad. The last time Amu came back to Imanum, Rahel had just been expelled from Nazareth Convent for decorating dung and slamming into seniors. Amu had lost the latest of her succession of jobs as a receptionist in a cheap hotel because she had been ill and had missed too many days of work. The hotel couldn't afford that, they told her. They needed a healthier receptionist. On that last visit, Amu spent the morning with Rahel in her room. With the last of her meager salary, she had bought her daughter small presents wrapped in brown paper with colored paper hearts pasted on. A packet of cigarette sweets, a tin phantom pencil box, and Paul Bunyan, a junior classics illustrated comic. They were presents for a 7-year-old. Rahel was nearly 11. It was as though Amu believed that if she refused to acknowledge the passage of time, if she willed it to stand still in the lives of her twins, it would. As though sheer willpower was enough to suspend her children's childhoods until she could afford to have them living with her. Then they could take up from where they left off, start again from 7. Amu told Rahel that she had bought Esther a comic too, but that she'd kept it away from him until she got another job and could earn enough to rent a room for the three of them to stay together in. Then she'd go to Calcutta and fetch Esther. And he could have his comic. That day was not far off, Amu said. It could happen any day. Soon, rent would be no problem. She said she had applied for a UN job, and they would all live in The Hague with a Dutch ayah to look after them. Or, on the other hand, Amu said, she might stay on in India and do what she had been planning to do all along, start a school. Choosing between a career in education and a UN job wasn't easy, she said. But the thing to remember was that the very fact that she had a choice was a great privilege. But for the time being, she said, until she made her decision, she was keeping Esther's presence away for him. That whole morning, Amu talked incessantly. She asked Rahel questions, but never let her answer them. If Rahel tried to say something, Amu would interrupt with a new thought or query. She seemed terrified of what adult thing her daughter might say and thaw frozen time. Fear made her garrulous. She kept it at bay with her babble. She was swollen with cortisone, moon-faced, not the slender mother Rahel knew. Her skin was stretched over her puffy cheeks like shiny scar tissue that covers old vaccination marks.
When she smiled, her dimples looked as though they hurt. Her curly hair had lost its sheen and hung around her swollen face like a dull curtain. She carried her breath in a glass inhaler in her tattered handbag. Brown Brovon fumes. Each breath she took was like a war won against the steely fist that was trying to squeeze the air from her lungs. Rahel watched her mother breathe. Each time she inhaled, the hollows near her collarbones grew steep and filled with shadows. Amu coughed up a wad of phlegm into her handkerchief and showed it to Rahel. "You must always check it," she whispered hoarsely, as though phlegm was an arithmetic answer sheet that had to be revised before it was handed in. "When it's white, it means it isn't ripe. When it's yellow and has a rotten smell, it's ripe and ready to be coughed out. Phlegm is like fruit, ripe or raw. You have to be able to tell." Over lunch, she belched like a truck driver and said, "Excuse me," in a deep, unnatural voice. Rahel noticed that she had new, thick hairs in her eyebrows, long, like palps. Amu smiled at the silence around the table as she picked fried emperor fish off the bone. She said that she felt like a road sign with birds shitting on her. She had an odd, feverish glitter in her eyes. Mamachi asked her if she'd been drinking and suggested that she visit Rahel as seldom as possible. Amu got up from the table and left without saying a word, not even goodbye. "Go and see her off," Chako said to Rahel. Rahel pretended she hadn't heard him. She went on with her fish. She thought of the phlegm and nearly retched. She hated her mother then. Hated her. She never saw her again. Amu died in a grimy room in the Bharat Lodge in Alapi, where she had gone for a job interview as someone's secretary. She died alone, with a noisy ceiling fan for company, and no Esther to lie at the back of her and talk to her. She was 31. Not old, not young, but a viable, dieable age. She had woken up at night to escape from a familiar, recurrent dream in which policemen approached her with snicking scissors, wanting to hack off her hair. They did that in Kottayam to prostitutes whom they'd caught in the bazaar, branded them so that everybody would know them for what they were, veshas, so that new policemen on the beat would have no trouble identifying whom to harass. Amu always noticed them in the market, the women with vacant eyes and forcibly shaved heads, in the land where long, oiled hair was only for the morally upright. That night in the lodge, Amu sat up in the strange bed, in the strange room, in the strange town. She didn't know where she was. She recognized nothing around her, only her fear was familiar. The faraway man inside her began to shout. This time the steely fist never loosened its grip. Shadows gathered like bats in the steep hollows near her collarbone. The sweeper found her in the morning. He switched off the fan. She had a deep blue sack under one eye that was bloated like a bubble, as though her eye had tried to do what her lungs couldn't. Sometime close to midnight, the faraway man who lived in her chest had stopped shouting. A platoon of ants carried a dead cockroach sedately through the door, demonstrating what should be done with corpses. The church refused to bury Amu on several counts. So Chako hired a van to transport the body to the electric crematorium. He had her wrapped in a dirty bedsheet and laid out on a stretcher. Rahel thought she looked like a Roman senator. "Et tu, Amu," she thought, and smiled, remembering Esther. It was odd, driving through bright, busy streets with a dead Roman senator on the floor of the van. It made the blue sky bluer. Outside the van windows, people, like cut-out paper puppets, went on with their paper puppet lives.
Real life was inside the van, where real death was. Over the jarring bumps and potholes in the road, Amu's body jiggled and slid off the stretcher. Her head hit an iron bolt on the floor. She didn't wince or wake up. There was a hum in Rahel's head, and for the rest of the day, Chako had to shout at her if he wanted to be heard. The crematorium had the same rotten, run-down air of a railway station, except that it was deserted. No trains, no crowds. Nobody except beggars, derelicts, and the police custody dead were cremated there. People who died with nobody to lie at the back of them and talk to them. When Amu's turn came, Chako held Rahel's hand tightly. She didn't want her hand held. She used the slickness of crematorium sweat to slither out of his grip. No one else from the family was there. The steel door of the incinerator went up, and the muted hum of the eternal fire became a red roaring. The heat lunged out at them like a famished beast. Then Rahel's Amu was fed to it. Her hair, her skin, her smile, her voice. The way she used Kipling to love her children before putting them to bed. We be of one blood, thou and I. Her goodnight kiss. The way she held their faces steady with one hand, squashed-cheeked, fish-mouthed, while she parted and combed their hair with the other. The way she held knickers out for Rahel to climb into, left leg, right leg. All this was fed to the beast, and it was satisfied. She was their Amu and their Baba, and she had loved them double. The door of the furnace clanged shut. There were no tears. The crematorium in charge had gone down the road for a cup of tea and didn't come back for 20 minutes. That's how long Chako and Rahel had to wait for the pink receipt that would entitle them to collect Amu's remains. Her ashes. The grit from her bones. The teeth from her smile. The whole of her, crammed into a little clay pot. Receipt number Q498673. Rahel asked Chako how the crematorium management knew which ashes were whose. Chako said they must have a system. Had Esther been with them, he would have kept the receipt. He was the keeper of records, the natural custodian of bus tickets, bank receipts, cash memos, checkbook stubs. Little man. He lived in a caravan, dumb, dumb. But Esther wasn't with them. Everybody decided it was better this way. They wrote to him instead. Mamachi said Rahel should write too. Write what? My dear Esther, how are you? I'm well. Amu died yesterday. Rahel never wrote to him. There are things that you can't do, like writing letters to a part of yourself, to your feet or hair or heart. In Papachi's study, Rahel, not old, not young, with floor dust on her feet, looked up from the wisdom exercise notebook and saw that Estepan Unknown was gone. She climbed down, off the stool, off the table, and walked out to the veranda. She saw Esther's back disappearing through the gate. It was mid-morning and about to rain again. The green, in the last moments of that strange, glowing pre-shower light, was fierce. A cock crowed in the distance, and its voice separated into two, like a sole peeling off an old shoe. Rahel stood there with her tattered wisdom notebooks, in the front veranda of an old house, below a button-eyed bison head, where years ago, on the day that Sophie Moll came, "Welcome Home, Our Sophie Moll" was performed. Things can change in a day. Chapter 8. Welcome Home, Our Sophie Moll. It was a grand old house, the Imanum House, but aloof-looking, as though it had little to do with the people who lived in it. Like an old man with roomy eyes watching children play,
seeing only transience in their shrill elation and their wholehearted commitment to life. The steep, tiled roof had grown dark and mossy with age and rain. The triangular wooden frames fitted into the gables were intricately carved. The light that slanted through them and fell in patterns on the floor was full of secrets. Wolves, flowers, iguanas, changing shape as the sun moved through the sky, dying punctually at dusk. The doors had not two, but four shutters of paneled teak, so that in the old days, ladies could keep the bottom half closed, lean their elbows on the ledge, and bargain with visiting vendors without betraying themselves below the waist. Technically, they could buy carpets or bangles with their breasts covered and their bottoms bare. Technically. Nine steep steps led from the driveway up to the front veranda. The elevation gave it the dignity of a stage, and everything that happened there took on the aura and significance of performance. It overlooked Baby Kuchma's ornamental garden. The gravel driveway looped around it, sloping down towards the bottom of the slight hill that the house stood on. It was a deep veranda, cool even at midday, when the sun was at its scorching best. When the red cement floor was laid, the egg whites from nearly 900 eggs went into it. It took a high polish. Below the stuffed, button-eyed bison head, with the portraits of her father-in-law and mother-in-law on either side, Mamachi sat in a low wicker chair at a wicker table on which stood a green glass vase with a single stem of purple orchids curving from it. The afternoon was still and hot. The air was waiting. Mamachi held a gleaming violin under her chin. Her opaque 50s sunglasses were black and slanty-eyed, with rhinestones on the corners of the frames. Her sari was starched and perfumed, off-white and gold. Her diamond earrings shone in her ears like tiny chandeliers. Her ruby rings were loose. Her pale, fine skin was creased like cream on cooling milk and dusted with tiny red moles. She was beautiful, old, unusual, regal. Blind mother widow with a violin. In her younger years, with prescience and good management, Mamachi had collected all her falling hair in a small embroidered purse that she kept on her dressing table. When there was enough of it, she made it into a netted bun, which she kept hidden in a locker with her jewelry. A few years earlier, when her hair began to thin and silver, to give it body, she wore her jet-black bun pinned to her small silver head. In her book, this was perfectly acceptable, since all the hair was hers. At night, when she took off her bun, she allowed her grandchildren to plait her remaining hair into a tight, oiled, gray rat's tail with a rubber band at the end. One plaited her hair, while the other counted her uncountable moles. They took turns. On her scalp, carefully hidden by her scanty hair, Mamachi had raised, crescent-shaped ridges. Scars of old beatings from an old marriage. Her brass vase scars. She played lentement, a movement from the suite in D, G of Handel's Water Music. Behind her slanted sunglasses, her useless eyes were closed, but she could see the music as it left her violin and lifted into the afternoon like smoke. Inside her head, it was like a room with dark drapes drawn across a bright day. As she played, her mind wandered back over the years to her first batch of professional pickles. How beautiful they had looked, bottled and sealed, standing on a table near the head of her bed, so they'd be the first thing she would touch in the morning when she woke up. She had gone to bed early that night, but woke a little after midnight. She groped for them, and her anxious fingers came away with a film of oil. The pickle bottle stood in a pool of oil. There was oil everywhere. In a ring under her vacuum flask, under her Bible, all over her bedside table. The pickled mangoes had absorbed oil and expanded, making the bottles leak. Mamachi consulted a book that Chaco bought her, Home Scale Preservations,
but it offered no solutions. Then she dictated a letter to Annamachandi's brother-in-law, who was the regional manager of Padma Pickles in Bombay. He suggested that she increase the proportion of preservative that she used, and the salt. That had helped, but didn't solve the problem entirely. Even now, after all those years, Paradise Pickles bottles still leaked a little. It was imperceptible, but they did still leak. And on long journeys, their labels became oily and transparent. The pickles themselves continued to be a little on the salty side. Mamachi wondered whether she would ever master the art of perfect preservation and whether Sophie Moore would like some iced grape crush, some cold purple juice in a glass. Then she thought of Margaret Kochema, and the languid, liquid notes of Handel's music grew shrill and angry. Mamachi had never met Margaret Kochema, but she despised her anyway. Shopkeeper's daughter was how Margaret Kochema was filed away in Mamachi's mind. Mamachi's world was arranged that way. If she was invited to a wedding in Kottayam, she would spend the whole time whispering to whoever she went with. The bride's maternal grandfather was my father's carpenter. Kunyukuttiyippan? His great-grandmother's sister was just a midwife in Trivandrum. My husband's family used to own this whole hill. Of course, Mamachi would have despised Margaret Kochema even if she had been heir to the throne of England. It wasn't just her working-class background Mamachi resented. She hated Margaret Kochema for being Chaku's wife. She hated her for leaving him, but would have hated her even more had she stayed. The day that Chaku prevented Papachi from beating her, and Papachi had murdered his chair instead, Mamachi packed her wifely luggage and committed it to Chaco's care. From then onwards, he became the repository of all her womanly feelings, her man, her only love. She was aware of his libertine relationships with the women in the factory, but had ceased to be hurt by them. When Baby Kochema brought up the subject, Mamachi became tense and tight-lipped. "He can't help having a man's needs," she said primly. Surprisingly, Baby Kochema accepted this explanation, and the enigmatic, secretly thrilling notion of men's needs gained implicit sanction in the Imanam house. Neither Mamachi nor Baby Kochema saw any contradiction between Chaku's Marxist mind and feudal libido. They only worried about the Naxalites, who had been known to force men from good families to marry servant girls whom they had made pregnant. Of course, they did not even remotely suspect that the missile, when it was fired, the one that would annihilate the family's good name forever, would come from a completely unexpected quarter. Mamachi had a separate entrance built for Chaku's room, which was at the eastern end of the house, so that the objects of his needs wouldn't have to go traipsing through the house. She secretly slipped them money to keep them happy. They took it because they needed it. They had young children and old parents, or husbands who spent all their earnings in toddy bars. The arrangement suited Mamachi because in her mind, a fee clarified things. Disjuncted sex from love, needs from feelings. Margaret Kochema, however, was a different kettle of fish altogether. Since she had no means of finding out, though she did once try to get Kochemaria to examine the bedsheets for stains, Mamachi could only hope that Margaret Kochema was not intending to resume her sexual relationship with Chaco. While Margaret Kochema was in Imanam, Mamachi managed her unmanageable feelings by slipping money into the pockets of the dresses that Margaret Kochema left in the laundry bin. Margaret Kochema never returned the money simply because she never found it. Her pockets were emptied as a matter of routine by Anian, the dhobi. Mamachi knew this, but preferred to construe Margaret Kochema's silence as a tacit acceptance of payment for the favors Mamachi imagined she bestowed on her son. So Mamachi had the satisfaction of regarding Margaret Kochema as just another whore,
Anian the Dhobi was happy with his daily gratuity, and of course Margaret Kochma remained blissfully unaware of the whole arrangement.
From its perch on the well, an untidy kukal called whoop, whoop, and shuffled its rust-red wings. A crow stole some soap that bubbled in its